Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
It is my pleasure to be back in the hosting seat. And today we've got a ripper of an episode. Dave and Pete and I are chatting about how we can help our kids get onto the property ladder, and whether they're our kids or our friends' kids or just kids out there, we've all got a role to play if this is something that we see an opportunity to do. So I'm really looking forward to this one. Dave, how are you going?
I'm going well, thanks, Kate. The figures have just come out for March, and you know, we've seen the largest growth since 1988 in the month of March this year. So yeah. Finally, the data is starting to show what we've been talking about since late last year.
I agree with you, but I think it's going to get a little bit headier, and I suspect this time next month we'll be seeing claims that this is the hottest market we've had in 40 or 50 years, because as you both know, the data is still getting collated and it's only coming in, and we've had a lot of very recent growth as well. So I suspect what we're looking at is Jan-Feb data, not actually April data. Pete, would you agree?
Yeah, look, I think the market is still very hot. I had a quick look at the CoreLogic website before we came on, and I saw all green lights, every capital city for every period of time, whether it's 1 month, one quarter, 12 months, whether it's houses or units, everything is green. And, you know, very rare that you see that, all capital cities all going in the same direction. So, yeah, it's for those people that own property, in particular multiple properties, it's a wonderful time. But it's a bit hard for our kids to get in.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one, because when we look at affordability, and in particular the interest rate environment that we're in, and how much young borrowers can leverage, and some of the government assistance that's out there, for example, a 5% deposit, and then we've got our government backing the rest of the deposit so that they're not having to stump up the lender's mortgage insurance. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. And Dave, you and I are a similar vintage. We didn't get any leg ups from the government when it was our turn. We paid the full stamps. We had to save more, and interest rates were not at these levels. So I actually think that first home buyers definitely have an opportunity, and in some regards an easier opportunity. Despite the fact that prices are high, I'm seeing a lot of very powerful bidding out there, and it's the first home buyer contingent that are really running that.
Yeah, there's a reason why first time buyers are the largest percentage of people who have been buying property during this property run, and it's exactly the reasons you've just talked about. The level of stimulus and support, along with the low rates, at a level we've never seen before, and obviously that's because we've just been through a pandemic, and it's reflected in first-time buyers really being the primary reason we're seeing this property market surge in the way it has been.
And what's really interesting is if we think about first-time buyers and how they typically have their borrowing capacity calculated, unlike people who have equity behind them, and so for them it's really just a function of servicing. In other words, their borrowing capacity is a direct reflection of how much cash they earn and what sort of surplus they've got. A first-time buyer is restricted by the size of their deposit, because if they've got a really strong salary but they've only got a certain amount of savings, and even on a 95% LVR, they are capped at what they can borrow. And if we think about what happened during COVID, especially in Melbourne, we were all stuck at home. We weren't spending, we were saving. And a lot of people, I've spoken to a lot of our clients who were able to save not just 10,000, but tens of thousands. So let's just imagine they saved 10 grand and it's a 95 LVR, and they've got the servicing to be able to support their borrowings. That's an extra $200,000 that they can borrow on a 95 LVR, just with $10,000 in savings.
Yeah, and certainly one of the reasons why the first time buyers are flying at the moment is because we know we've got record levels of savings. And, you know, so the first-time buyers, have, as you've just said, have got record level of savings probably historically for first-time buyers, certainly across the board that's the case. Mm-hmm. And it's probably a good example of why parents are contributing more than they ever have. So, you know, the average contribution is $89,000 at the moment, and that's 20% higher than it was 12 months ago.
Because that's because mums and dads have also been saving as well as the kids. So everyone's been saving. There was limited opportunity to spend for a lot of COVID-19. So they got their pockets full of cash. Money is cheap. So that's why we're seeing such a frenzy out there in the property market being led by first-time buyers.
And it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy because the more equity growth they're experiencing because of this rush, the higher the wealth effect, so their feeling of their sense of wealth and their willingness to be generous with their kids because they're feeling wealthy. So it's a really tough predicament that we're all in at the moment, and I'm not really seeing a way around this until the data indicates that we've spun a little bit out of control and we can anticipate then that the lenders might be forced to do something. But it's such a wait and see. We're not seeing any moves yet, only a lot of murmurs.
Yeah, and the Australian Financial Review had their banking summit this week on Tuesday. So many of the bank CEOs, investment company CEOs, Warren Byers, who heads up APRA, spoke, and you know he was pretty clear that firstly their job is not to regulate the property market. Their job is to make sure that there's no systemic risk within bank lending in Australia. And at the moment, you know, he doesn't see any systemic risk, but still I'll keep saying that as the media and political pressure increases, which it's only going to really escalate as we keep seeing price increases like we have, he might get a tap on the shoulder sooner than anticipated to maybe pull some strings to slow down lending. But at the moment, he's certainly saying he can't see that happening in the short term.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I was going to say, what's your market update? But I think we're all probably sitting on a very similar market update. And I love this topic because it's so relevant. And, you know, all the parents in us, our listeners, will probably get quite excited to hear how they can help their kids. And I get the question all the time, I'm sure you do as well, Dave, and there's more than one way to help your children. In fact, there's several ways, and it's not all necessarily gifting them money or lending them money or giving them equity to use. There's lots of wonderful ways that parents can morally support their kids too and guide them to the right people or to the right resources too. So on that note, let's kick this off. And from a finance point of view, I'd love to talk about gifts. So when parents gift their kids stuff, there's obviously an implication there, Dave. So over to you.
Yeah, so basically gifting is providing a lump sum of money to go towards the deposit. It is one of the prime ways that parents can help their kids get into the property market. The main way, which we'll get to, is providing a property as security. That's the most popular way now. But providing a gift allows the first-time buyer, as you touched on before, Kate, often it's not actually the borrowing capacity that holds them back. It is their access to savings. You know, a lot of first-time buyers are pre-kids, so they don't have those extra costs, reducing their borrowing capacity. So a gift from the parents will obviously speed up their ability to get into the market.
Talk to us about how lenders view gifts and what the difference is between a gift and genuine savings and what sort of magnitude we need to see.
Genuine savings is your own proven savings over a period of time, and a gift is obviously, as the word says, it's a gift from someone. Now, what you need to do is actually the parents or whoever provides the gift needs to sign a stat deck that it is a genuine gift versus a loan. And often these things are loans behind the scenes that people want to portray as a gift. So the banks do require you to sign a stat deck that it is a gift. And if it is a loan, they will factor that into, you know, they want to know the terms of the loan.
Yeah. I've seen all kinds of creative ways that parents have plonked money in accounts for the purposes of helping their kids, and sometimes it's not helpful. So also to shed some light on this, if a lender needs to see genuine savings to a certain amount, let's say it's they need to see 10% or 5% of the property's value saved as genuine savings, they'll expect to see that over a period of time. So if a parent wants to help their kids qualify for a loan by, you know, dumping 50 grand in their account and withdrawing it the next day, it doesn't work like that. So it's a workaround that banks are completely onto and have been for years.
So, Dave, genuine savings, how far back are the banks going to go to see how long you've been saving?
Mostly it's 3 months only, but it can be 3 to 6, depending on the lender and the lender policy.
If I gave my kid $50,000 7 months ago, bank's not going to check that?
Probably, yeah.
Right.
Okay. It depends on where it originates from. You know, if it says Sport Bet or, you know, Crown Casino or something, they're going to ask some questions. They're still distilling statements and wanting to know where money is coming from and where it's going.
Yeah, and it's a good example of why first-time buyers should be planning well ahead of time because, yeah, you want to get your ducks in a row and know if you are going to get a gift, well, yeah, ideally get it in the bank well in advance. Mm-hmm. So that your picture looks like the way you want to portray it when you apply for the loan.
I want to chat about a different kind of property gift because money is definitely one generous way to do it. I see a lot of parents wanting to buy their children the property outright, which is pretty amazing, but it also raises other questions because we all like to have a sense of pride and achievement, and if our parents just give us something that might be taken away from us. However, I often see parents when they've got really little kids planning ahead and thinking about what they can buy when their little Johnny goes to uni. And I always talk about the risk in that because little Johnny might not go to uni or he might not go to uni in Parkville in Melbourne. He could be anywhere on the globe. So it's always a risk when a parent earmarks a location or wants the kids to live in the same street as them without understanding where the child's life is going to take them into adulthood. Pete, have you got thoughts on that?
Oh, look, what parents do for their kids is going to range hugely. Some will do nothing, some because they don't want to, some because they can't. Others, at the other extreme, yeah, might gift them a house. And, you know, we've all got our different views on those different aspects. But I can share what I've done with one of my children. So with all of my kids, I've said, for any significant purchase, I'm willing to go 50-50. Whether that was when they were young, and they were buying some special toys, you know, if they came up with 50% of it, I'd give them the other 50%. And then they grew older and then it became a mobile phone and then it was their car. And now with the first one, it's been a house. So I said, whatever money you save up for a deposit, I'll go 50-50. So we did that, but she still didn't have enough money to buy a property on her own. I felt that this was too good a property to let go. So on top of that, I said, all right, well, I will buy 50%. So really what we're looking at is two methods in one. One is, let's call it a gift, right? But I'm not just giving you money for nothing. You come up with some money and I'll gift you the equivalent amount. And the other one was, we're going to go 50-50 in this house. I'll own half, you'll own half. But before you do that, I'd suggest that you need to work out an exit strategy. Because I said to her clearly, like, my plan is not to hold this property forever. My plan was to help you. Within 5 years, we need to work out either I'm buying you out, you're buying me out, or we're selling it. They're our choices. So they're just two examples of how I've helped my kids. But like I said before, you know, there is a wide spectrum of how parents can help their kids into the property market. But it's dependent on their financial position, cultural issues as well. But one of the issues with parents helping their kids is one reaction is it's just fueling the property market. So they can borrow money from the bank, but they can also get money gifted or borrow money, in quotation marks, from the bank of mum and dad. You know, there's positives and negatives.
There is indeed. My personal philosophy is I want my children to feel like they've really achieved something and they've put their own hard yards into it. And if that means helping them to get there, that's okay as well. And I'm a bit like you, Pete. Dave, you're the one with little kids, so you're yet to experience this. I've got a 26-year-old stepson whom I love dearly and a daughter who is well and truly into the mobile phone phase and approaching car phase. And 50-50 has always been my mantra with saving as well. And it's been a joy to watch Rob take advantage of the opportunity. And he's on to his second property now, using the equity out of his 50% share from our joint property. So that's, we're really proud of him. He's actually down in Geelong working really hard. He's a chippy. He's taken some time off. So hi, Rob. I know he listens. And, yeah, we're very proud of you.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
To move on to the next type of assistance, the next one is still a monetary style sense of assisting our kids. It's security guarantees.
Yeah, so the security guarantee is the most popular method nowadays. It's basically a security guarantee is a type of guarantee where the guarantor provides real estate as additional security for the borrower's loan. So, you know, your kid's loan will be secured by that property and or the property they purchase and your property. So it usually would be 80% of the value of the property they purchase plus potentially 20% of the value of the property they purchase plus any, if they fund the stamp duties, et cetera, would be secured against the parents' property. So the smaller portion is secured against the parents' property. Not many lenders will allow the kids to borrow more than 100% of the value of their property with 20% of it secured against your property. So there's still, in the worst case scenario, if the kids get into trouble and have to sell, at least the starting point is the loan amount is equal or often even less than the value of the property they purchased, despite the fact there's some lending secured against the parents' property. And the main benefit of that is that it saves the kids having to pay mortgage insurance, and it also minimises how much cash they need to put towards the purchase if they don't have as much cash, which also the other side of that coin is they then, the kids, have more money able to keep in their bank account, which obviously provides them with extra buffer if they have fluctuation in cash flow so they still can hold the property.
So, Dave, if let's say the mum and dad's property is worth $600,000, it's freehold, they've got no mortgage on it, the kids need $100,000. So is it a first mortgage that goes on the property by the bank to the value of $100,000? Is that correct?
Yeah, in essence, although if that property is unsecured, yes, then it would be the only mortgage over the parents' property. The banks prefer it to be an investment property than a home. So if in an absolute worst case scenario, the parents had to sell their property, they're not selling the parents' family home. But yeah, that's right. It's a mortgage against the parents' property.
Let's say if I was going to do that, the problem is I used to have an unsecured property, but now I've got a mortgage on it, so that's going to affect my borrowing capacity if I want to go and buy something else. No?
No, because think of it in two loans. The child takes on two loans. They've got an 80% loan against the property that they've just bought, and then they've got a 25% or a 20% loan against the parent's property. And it's them. They're on the hook for repaying both. And if a crisis wasn't averted and the bank had to step in and sell the child's property, they'll pay out the parents' portion first.
All right.
So okay. It just chews up your equity. So, you know, you might have, if your investment property is worth 600 and 80% of that's 480, and you might have a $250,000 loan on that investment property, so you've got $230,000 still available that you could leverage against, or your kids could leverage against to help them fund the purchase of a property, and then you don't have to give them cash. You don't have to go in on the title of buying a property with them. You're just providing them with security. And so that is the most popular because then, the parents don't have to give up their own cash and they don't have to go on the title and take on the risk, all the risk as jointly and severally liable.
There's a lot of paperwork, Pete. And for any listeners that are thinking, what a great idea, you've got to be prepared for the paperwork. And a lot of lenders require you to get independent legal advice. So you literally have to traipse into a legal office and sit in front of a solicitor, go through all of your documentation and have them spell out the risks. And I've seen parents panic at the last minute, which is understandable because the language is pretty heady. But the reality is that their exposure is capped, and if something goes pear-shaped, their loan portion is the first one to be paid out.
Beyond the whole property being at risk, time and effort is the is a big con for people. You've got to provide all your financial details, complete lender ID requirements, conduct evaluation, find the certificate of title if it's unencumbered, liaise with your existing lender if you have a mortgage on it, and provide a consent for a second mortgage, signing guarantor documents. And then there is a cost for the independent legal advice, and then a partial discharge fee with your existing mortgage as well. So there's more work, but you don't have to actually provide any money as you do with the other options.
And the beauty of this one, I've seen a lot of people go through this over the years, back dating back to when I was a mortgage broker and now as a buyer's agent, and not once have I seen a child, when I say a child, a recipient whose parents have enabled them this opportunity, not be super grateful and not be really determined to extinguish that loan at their first opportunity, whether it's working hard and paying it down or whether it's saving up that equity and getting the loan reevaluated and refinancing so that they can release their parents' loan. And I've seen it every time. It's always their first motivation.
So they still need to pay off the main loan to the bank, but they're also in the background at the same time, ideally working off to pay the loan that's secured against their parents' property.
Yeah, it's right. Just like 105% LVR.
But just spread over two different properties.
That's it,
Yeah, and it's often just one loan, Pete, but behind the scenes it's secured against two different properties, just like if you had one loan secured against your own home and an investment property.
Right, okay. Things awesome. Are becoming clearer now. Very
good. You're thinking about this for your other kids, aren't you?
No. So, I take the easy route. It's too complicated for me. Because we all understand 50-50. You know, you say $30,000, I'll give you $30,000. End of story. You don't encumber my title. I don't have to worry about anything else. Yes, I've foregone $30,000, but, you know, that's a gift as a reward as well, because you've been able to come up with $30,000. I've given you $30,000. Off you go.
But you are on title on those properties?
No, nothing.
Oh, you're just giving a simple gift, that's it.
Just a gift, but my gift's based on you do some of the, you save some of the money and I'll give you some of the money as well.
Yeah, and gift is the simplest, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. But you have to actually, provide.
Yeah, you've got to have the $30,000 cash.
Yeah.
And be willing to do without it. Yep.
Well, let's talk about co-borrowing briefly because, Pete, you already touched on it. But, Dave, I'd like to explore with you how this works because it's not necessarily joint borrowers. Sometimes it's tenants in common. And people have to have a really good arrangement. When they're joint borrowing or when we're co-borrowing with anybody, whether it be a parent or a sibling, you need to have an arrangement. Mm. So let's chat about that one.
Well, that's what you've done, isn't it?
It was, for the very first one.
Yeah. So, you know, you probably know more about it than me, Kate.
Well, Pete was saying, you know, he had a deal as well. He didn't want his capital tied up forever, so he needed an exit strategy. I'm the opposite. So I tied poor Rob. He was told that there is no exit strategy. It's a buy and hold forever. And the rules were you're not allowed to live in it, you're not allowed to sell it, and you can only get equity out of it for residential purchases, not for anything else. No jet skis, holidays, cars, nothing, just residential property. And he's doing that now and doing it beautifully. But that was, I know that I've tied caveats to it. That's what we do as parents. But I'm really thrilled with how it's going because property is a long game. We all know that. However, you've always got to think about how you're buying with someone because I would have a joint purchase with my husband. And if I die, he gets everything. If he dies, I get everything. But when it's with a child, you've got to think differently about it because their life will take them somewhere and they'll have their own relationships and kids, etc. So a joint purchase won't necessarily work well. And that's where you can enter tenants in common. And that means if it's a 50% tenants in common deal and I die, my 50% goes to my beneficiary and likewise for him. And I know it's awful to hinge on death, but you can also play around with the ratios when you've got a tenants in common arrangement. So let's say he was only good for saving up a quarter of it, then we could be 25-75 or vice versa. So you have a degree of control over how much of an ownership you have when you've got an arrangement like that. And it pays to get great advice on a tenants in common arrangement, but I see it a lot with co-borrowing and siblings and parents, etc.
That's exactly what we did. So we're tenants in common, my daughter and I, and as you say, you know, when I pass away, my share will go to my beneficiaries and the same for her. So I think that's probably a very smart move, what you've done, Kate, and what I've done, rather than joint tenants with the child. Because as you said, the child is hopefully going to go through some other life stages where they may have some other significant partners who would like a share of that particular property one day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say to our listeners that you want to be in a pretty strong financial position to take that path, and probably, well, it depends how strong your financial position is, but if you're, you know, liable for the lending, jointly and severally liable, you know, your borrowing capacity is obviously reasonably impacted. And, yeah, you don't want to obviously be in a position where you're the one who's needing to make some negative decisions around maybe having to divest the property because of your own financial situation. So I think you've clearly got really clear rules there, Kate, and that's critical. But I'd just say everyone's got to pick what's right for them as well, and that's obviously right for you too. But I do think, you know, you want to be, there are obviously reasonably big risks with that approach. So I just think you want to be in a strong financial position as the parent helping out your kids in a situation like that.
Yeah, for sure. Now, we've talked about how we can help them financially. And what we haven't talked about is some of the most powerful ways of helping them, which I think is actually about educating them in terms of financial literacy and supporting them. So whether we're able to support them by going around and looking at properties with them, or skilling up through reading and getting our hands on some really good material, or even finding someone great who's independent who can support them. And even as recently as today, I chatted to a mum who's paying my fee for her son because she wants to help him but recognises that professional help is the way that she'd most like to help him. So there's lots of different ways that we can help our kids. It doesn't always require giving them a generous bursary or going on title or giving up equity. We can support them in lots of ways. Pete, I'd love to tap into you because I see you supporting all of your children on their financial path, and your daughters are a bit older than my daughter. So can you share with me some of the non-financial ways that you think are most valuable for young people?
And about 20 years older than my daughter.
So mine's been mainly through informal education. Like we try to involve the kids in our property investment portfolio. We talk about it at the dinner table. In the early days, we used to take them to open inspections, but they soon got to hate that, even though we would bribe them with ice creams or trips to the beach.
I have a big tin of Chupa Chups in the back of my car for that very reason.
But in the main, it's worked. Like three out of my four kids, well, one's got a half share on a property with me, but the other two are very keen. They've got a separate bank account. They're putting money aside for a deposit. One, and I won't say which one, still not interested yet, you know, wants to live the high life in one of the major capital cities of Australia and rent, but that's okay. But the other very rewarding thing is my kids' friends are also asking me. Like when they're looking to buy either a home or their first investment property, you know, they have a chat to one of my kids, hey, do you mind asking your dad what he thinks about this one? You know, and I'm happy to give my opinion. I'll go onto realestate.com or whatever link they sent to me. I'll go onto CoreLogic, do a bit of research, and just give them my opinion. And one of the hardest things I find is trying to keep kids away from buying new stuff because it all looks fantastic. But if we're talking about capital growth, you know, it's not going to do you any good. But, you know, it's hard to keep kids away from brand new cars as well because they all look good.
All your life you've been buying new things, haven't you? Pretty much.
Yeah, true. Yeah, new clothes, new TVs, new phones.
New toys. Yeah.
Very true. That's what I do, Kate. There was nothing that we set out to do, nothing formal, but... And all I'm doing is mirroring what happened when I was growing up, because our listeners may remember that my dad was a real estate agent. Real estate talk was at the dinner table every day, you know, and encouraging me to buy property. And I would go out with dad and and help him to do some work on his investment properties. I didn't hate that as much as my children do. No, I learned a lot from my dad, and hopefully I'll pass that on to my kids.
And Dave, you've got little ones, so I always love chatting to parents in the know and in the industry about what their future plans are, because as we know, kids all, Pete's just identified that his kids have varying appetites and levels of interest in property acquisition. What's your plan?
Look, I wrote down three things. One, teaching them about money management. Two, start investing young. And three, ultimately, the repetition of the right investment and money management messages from a young age. Just continually, continual repetition is my plan. Talking to them about these things and just developing the right, I guess, mindsets and habits around investing and money management. So those are the three things. Mine are 7, 5, and 2. You know, we're just starting early days of pocket money and, yeah, just teaching them that save some of what you receive, talk to them about investing and the concept of growing your money and making your money work for you.
Yeah, it doesn't always go to plan, and I'm testament to that.
Yeah.
I've got a 14-year-old who's learning about credit worthiness and assessment decisions right now because she applied for some credit. She gets paid to give me a shoulder rub or, you know, head massage or doing little jobs, and she wanted to go shopping with her friends and the date was burning and the money wasn't there, and she asked if she could have a cash advance, and I was really clear about the rules around the cash advance and the repayment schedule that was on offer, and she didn't stick to it. So yeah, she blemished her credit record and we put her on stop credit. And that was a tough learning for her, but it's interesting because your kids go through all kinds of stages as they grow up, and I guess 14, 15 is where they're most likely to have a bit of a bad attitude towards credit. But, yeah, the best of plans. I've yet to see how she comes out of that teenage cave and into adulthood. I look forward to it.
Yeah, look, I certainly don't have my head in the sand about thinking they'll definitely follow the advice, because I can already see how they regularly don't follow my advice and direction, and I'm sure money management and investing will be no different at times and have its ups and downs.
Yeah. Now, you touched on something before, Pete, about open and honest conversations around, you know, wealth building and property. And I think so many people associate building wealth as something that you can't talk to your kids about, or something that should be secret or private, or that you can't be proud of. And unfortunately, it's a bit of a funny one for a lot of people to get their heads around. But I've always been of the belief that we should talk about what's going on and how hard we've worked and the sacrifice that is required for things, because you don't want your kids to just think one day that it all happened for you by magic. What sort of degree of detail do you go into? Do you share cash flow projections? Do you talk about some of the obligations you have as a landlord?
Well, they generally hear about the obligations we have as landlord as a heated discussion over the dinner table if something's gone wrong. I mean, we don't go into all the nitty-gritty. Number one, they're still kids. And number two, not all the nitty-gritty is of interest to them.
Yeah.
But they know which investment properties we own. They have some idea what they're worth. They probably don't know what rent they're earning, because that doesn't really interest them. But most questions would be answered fully and truthfully and honestly. That's the way we work in our household. But again, you know, not every household does, whether it's for financial reasons, culture reasons, whatever it might be. That's just what we do. I'm not saying that's what everyone should do, but that's just what we do.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something for everyone, isn't there? Now, we're coming towards the end of our episode, and what I'd love to do is ask you both to think about a good, juicy gold nugget to share with our listeners.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Okay, Pete, I'm going to hand the reins over to you. What's your gold nugget?
My gold nugget is to be a good role model. You can teach the kids as much as you like. You can, you know, get them to read books. But what's going to be of greatest influence is watching you manage your money, watching how, what investments you make, what sorts of properties, and your attitude towards money as well. Like, are you a good saver? Are you the sort of person that money comes in and then the money goes out? So I think acting as a good role model is probably the best way that parents can help their kids purchase a home.
I love it. Very true. Dave, over to you.
Yeah, well, look, now that the Bank of Mum and Dad is so prevalent with $34 billion in loans, that's bigger than HSBC, AMP and Bank of Queensland, many parents are thinking about how do they ensure their gift remains belonging to their child if they're buying with a partner and they might split up down the track. So in that case, it's really important that you have a binding financial agreement, or your child has a prenuptial agreement, which are legal documents. And here both spouses acknowledge the existence of the gift as belonging to one spouse and acknowledge that the gift is not divisible with the other spouse in the event of relationship breakdown. That is one way, because I know, you know, many parents ask questions about that before providing a gift. I probably shouldn't finish on such a negative note.
It's a tough one. You know, it really is tough because, you know, I know as a parent, you want to see your children making their own decisions as well and finding happiness with the partner that they enjoy being with. And I think I would personally struggle with gifting money or assisting financially and then saying, but here's the caveat around that. I'm okay with the caveat around not selling the property or not buying a jet ski, but having it, it's a very personal decision. And prenups, they come up a lot these days. And it, as Pete said, when it comes to helping your kids and what decisions you make, it's one of the most entirely private and really
personal.
Very personal. Yeah.
People have different lines in the sand, and you might want to have an agreement if they're not married, but not have one if they were married. Who knows? So, yeah, it's up to each individual, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love a great episode that sparks a degree of healthy debate and has a bit of happiness at the end as well. So, guys, thank you so much for a really fun episode.
Thanks, Kate.
Look forward to the next one.
See you next week, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about how you can help your kids on their property journey or help yourself if you're a first-time buyer, take a listen to episode 6, What Determines Your Property Strategy. Episode 24, How Mortgage Strategy Shapes Your Ability to Hold Property and How It Pays Off for Decades to Come. Episode 30, Money Management, 7 Steps to Success. Episode 48, Why Established Properties Outperform. Episode 53, Bad Credit Behaviour, What Does It Mean and How Can It Be Solved Before It's Too Late. And finally, Episode 67, Goal Setting Fundamentals for Property Success.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.